Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In your eyes, the light, the heat.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and this, of course, is In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel, the song that was playing when John Cusack held that boombox outside of Diane's bedroom at the end of Say Anything, and it has become synonymous with the grand cinematic romantic gesture, right? Well, my next guest says that John Cusack's character from Say Anything leads the pack of the many romantic heroes that made her swoon in her youth. But more recently, with a little distance and through the lens of Me Too, seem problematic. Edward Cullen from Twilight, Chuck Bass from Gossip Girl, Spike from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, that guy from Love Actually with The Sign. My next guest says all of these characters in some way crossed or at least blurred the lines of consent, aggressively pursuing women with little or no regard for their desires. But these characters' actions, and those of countless other leading men across the pop culture landscape, are more likely to be portrayed as charming than scary, writes Julie Beck, senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Her most recent article is called When Pop Culture Sells Dangerous Myths About Romance. Julie, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And listeners, we'll invite your examples of this. Is there something in pop culture that you've been thinking about differently lately? Movies, TV shows, books, music that you once loved but now find slightly unsettling or problematic or even offensive? You heard some of those examples off the bat there. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, for Julie Beck from The Atlantic. So you're right. Research has already found that romantic comedies can normalize stalking behavior. It's not difficult, then, to imagine that toxic love stories can also normalize coercion. They can make people, women especially, question when and whether their boundaries have really been violated, when they should be flattered, and when they should be afraid. So let's start with one example that you give, the TV show General Hospital, which is the longest-running soap opera in production. How does General Hospital normalize coercion?
Yeah, General Hospital is actually the most extreme example in the article, probably, because the story of the super couple, Luke and Laura, I think they were actually the couple that coined this term, super couple. Their relationship started when he raped her. And then later, the show kind of retconned that into calling it a seduction rather than a rape. And they had this whole romance. It was a fan favorite. They got married. The marriage episode was like the highest rated episode ever at the time. And even the actor who played Luke has said, you know, that rape was romanticized and that's something that he regrets. So
you assert that General Hospital therefore portrayed sexual assault not as a definitive shattering of trust, but as a foundation on which a relationship can be built. It's pretty creepy when we look at it that way.
Yeah, and I mean, that is something that's happened to varying degrees in other shows too. And I think it may have something to do with the sort of serial nature of television, right? Where they kind of have this like assault amnesia. If they don't want the character to be seen as a villain anymore, they just write it in a different direction.
Other examples in the same category that you cite are Blade Runner and Game of Thrones. Why them?
And so Blade Runner is interesting because they just had that sequel come out, right? And there was a critic at Slate who wrote that a big part of the new Blade Runner, the plot has to do with the fact that in the original movie, Deckard, the hero, and the android Rachel fell in love. But if you go back to the movie, like when that moment when they have sex, when they fall in love, whatever, he's forcing himself on her and she looks like very scared. She tries to run away. He slams the door and like kind of puts her up against the wall. So it's not, it doesn't seem ambiguous. And yet, you know, they're kind of portraying it as like a sexy moment.
And you're right that there's something about the serial nature of television in particular, and you were just saying this, which means many shows suffer from a kind of, you use the phrase assault amnesia, or even rape amnesia, when it's no longer convenient for a character who once raped or committed an attempted rape on somebody to be seen as a villain. And you point to Gossip Girl as another example of something having this sort of issue. Can you talk about Gossip Girl?
Yeah, Gossip Girl is kind of a crazy case. In the pilot, this character, Chuck Bass, tries to force himself on two different girls. And he's, very much the villain from the beginning. But later, the writer sort of moved him in a direction of having this romantic entanglement with Blair Waldorf, who's one of the main girls. And it's interesting because they do morph him into a romantic lead, but at the same time, he doesn't really shed that streak that he had. Their whole thing is that they kind of play these games with each other, and they, one pursues the other, and then another pursues the other, and it turns in, they do these sort of weird games and manipulations and tricks, and that's their whole thing. But sometimes that is very questionable. There's an episode where Chuck Bass is pretending to be Blair's boyfriend. She's dating someone else at the time. There's a blackout. He pretends that he's her boyfriend and goes into a dark room with her, and they start hooking up because he's pretending that he's someone else. So very, very, crossing lines of consent.
And Buffy the Vampire Slayer, also with a rape amnesia problem.
Yeah, that was another. And so the Blair and Chuck romance, I should mention, is one that the fans adored, myself included, honestly, at the time. And again, the vampire spike on Buffy was another fan favorite character. And there is an episode where he tries to rape Buffy, and then the show just kind of forgets about it. He goes away for a while. He gets a soul because he's a vampire. And then he comes back and they're... they don't become romantically involved again, it doesn't seem, but they become close again, have a very close friendship, and they just don't really deal with it.
My guest is Julie Beck, Associate Senior Editor at The Atlantic, who's got a new article called When Pop Culture Sells Dangerous Myths About Romance, and it's pretty eye-popping and pretty disturbing when you read the so many examples that she came up with from movies and television about the normalization of sexual assault on, shows that everybody watched, and looking at them through different eyes these days and for the sake of this article. And our lines are full with people with their own examples or with questions for you. So let's hear first from Latasha in Patterson. Latasha, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. I wanted to point out the Steve Urkel character on Family Matters. He pursues Laura incessantly, even showing up at her house several times unannounced. And by the end of the series, he's friends with her father. He goes from being a French character to a main character. He's friends with her father. And she's pursuing him in the form of Stefan Urkel.
Familiar with it, Julie?
I'm slightly familiar with it, but she raises a good point, which is that a lot of times in these shows and movies, persistence is equated with romance, even if that persistence is not necessarily desired. So,
and more pervasive than actual rape in TV shows and movies, you write, is the romantic hero whose efforts at seduction look more like harassment. And maybe that's related to what you were just saying. You use Twilight as an example.
Yeah, and I think this applies to what she was just describing with Steve Urkel, too. These things that are, we accept them as romantic because that's what the world of the show or the book says that they are. But if you kind of look at it in the context of the real world, like Edward Cullen breaking into Bella's house to literally watch her sleep, in what world that would be romantic, I'm not sure. Going to someone's house repeatedly if they don't want you to come there, holding a boombox outside someone's window, that's only romantic because they get together in the end. If she was not interested, that would be a different story.
Delilah in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Delilah.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I listen to you every single day, and
thank
I love you.
You
so much.
Thank you.
I have an almost 2-year-old, and I grew up in the 90s, and basically the only music I enjoy and always have is hip hop. And so we play hip hop around the house for my son, and he does really like it. And so this has come up many times, but and this song by Kanye and Jay-Z that I really liked a while ago came on the display. So I turned it up, and my kid and I were both dancing in the car, and I started, like, the words are naughty, and I was kind of, like, having this conversation in my head, like, when do I need to start not playing just even bad words? And then this line came in the song that said something, Kanye's talking to a woman, and he said something like, get in the car and show why you deserve to have it all, meaning, like, sleep with me and I'll mm-hmm. give you money. And I was like, oh, man, like, when is my kid going to start putting... And I used to play this song all the time, and I never thought anything of it. And just yesterday, it just made me feel kind of gross. So I have that. I love hip-hop. Eminem now gives me a hard time to listen to. Like, some of his stuff is so hard to listen to. But there are a lot of groups who are good at but use dirty language and aren't saying misogynistic things. It's just the constant S-word, F-word. So it's interesting. I don't know what we'll do with that.
Yeah, good example. Delilah, and I mean your article, Julie, it's really television and movies. If we started down the road of music tracks, like Delilah's example, you know, and several examples that she didn't mention the songs by name, but you know, mentioned the artist, you could write three books.
Yeah, I mean, I did talk a bit about music in the piece as well. It's a little bit different with music because there's not as much of an overarching plot, right? Like sometimes there are, but she's absolutely right. There are tons of songs that kind of promote a similar narrative. And for me, what I kind of talked about in my piece is when I was a kid, I really liked emo music. And emo is a very like male dominated genre, you know, like you think Fall Out Boy, think Dashboard Confessional, Jimmy Eat World, all these bands. And they were also very aggressive in certain ways. And so sometimes this like, you know, romantic longing or whatever would get mixed in with honestly, like wishing violence towards women, and it's not something I thought about critically until embarrassingly late in life.
And here's another example of persistence, which we might see as crossing lines now, being persistent, being conflated with romance. The love story of Meredith Grey and Derek, quote, Dr. McDreamy himself on the medical drama Grey's Anatomy, begins with workplace harassment, and here's a clip.
I've been wondering to myself, why are you so hell-bent on getting me to go out with you? You know you're my boss. You know it's against the rules. You know I keep saying no. It's the chase.
What's fun, isn't it?
You see? This is a game to you, but not to me. Because unlike you, I still have something to prove.
Sounds like a textbook Me Too moment, although at least she's calling him on it in that scene.
Yeah, that's a very textbook one. I mean, the premise of that show, right, is in the pilot, she sleeps with a guy, it's a one-night stand, and then she shows up to work at the hospital on her first day and discovers that the guy she just slept with is her boss. So that's, you know, wacky and whatever, but then he continues to pursue her even after that, and even after, as you heard in the clip, she very clearly said, stop doing this. It's not a game. It's my career.
Ellen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellen.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay, great. So my question is actually regarding Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which I'm a huge fan of. I'm a little old now, but I grew up watching it. And the relationship between Spike and Buffy has always been a little bit problematic, where he's a vampire, he starts to aggressively pursue her, and at kind of at the apex of this, he attempts to rape her, which she's able to fight him off. But eventually, that rape is used as a turning point where he's so horrified by his actions that he goes out and tries to get his soul back to make sure that he never does it again. So that, to me, brings up a question. What is the point of redemption? Can these actions be changed? What do we do with people who might want to change? Where is that portrayed well, and what are your thoughts on that?
Julie, have you thought about that?
That's a great question. And I think that, you know, Buffy is an interesting example because they have this conceit of the vampires, right? And the vampires literally do not have souls. So when they do soulless things, you know, you can explain it that way. And he does go out and get his soul back and whatever. The problem for me with that storyline was less, you know, he feels bad about what he's done and he goes to try to redeem himself, but more they don't really deal with the fallout for their relationship realistically. Like Buffy and Spike don't talk about it. He doesn't really make amends specifically for that. He kind of comes back and helps her fight evil and what have you. But it's just, it doesn't feel like they address that in the way that the fallout would actually happen. I don't have off the top of my head examples of people in TV redeeming themselves well for something like that. If there are examples out there, that would be very interesting.
Ellen, thank you for that. And let's go to another Ellen, this one in Nyack. Ellen, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. Yeah, as a baby boomer feminist, I feel like I'm in a deja vu moment where we were going through all this in the 1970s, parsing the culture and remembering things like TV shows like the Lucille Ball and the Honeymooners, where the husband was very blithely always threatening domestic violence, really, basically, and nobody seemed to care about that. The shows were hits. But what's also occurred to me with what's happening right now is that I think both in films, TV, and in actual life, there's a certain amount of lookism going on, or attractive radar going on. I just recently re-saw a Pretty Girl,
Pretty Woman,
right, on TV, and what really struck me was that the so-called prostitute, Julia Roberts, was very enamored of the man who hired her, Richard Gere, because he is vastly attractive, and he treated her somewhat well. But there is a scene where she is attacked by Jason Alexander, his lawyer, and that's considered a horrible moment for her, and she defends herself against him, assaulting her. But, you know, the message was clear that when there's an attractive man assaulting you, it's not as terrible as an unattractive man. Mm-hmm. And I think that has come up a lot with, you know, the Me Too movement, Harvey Weinstein, and some of the other cases, that there does seem to be a selectiveness that comes out
in
the culture.
Lookism, in this case pertaining to the man. Have you thought about that dynamic, Julie?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting wrinkle to it. I mean, I think part of it is that Hollywood does sometimes resort to a very sort of basic aesthetic thing. It's a hard thing to sort of give a term to, but where they just equate, you know, beauty with good and ugliness with evil, and that's like a very basic aesthetic cue that is, you know, kind of hurtful and reductive in other ways besides just what she's talking about. But I think that is the case where, you know, if you understand as the viewer that this relationship has been set up to be a romance, like, you know, she's going to end up with Richard Gere. So therefore, like, everything that happens along the way is part of their love story. And that's just how it's framed to you. Whereas if you put the same action in, maybe framed it in the way of the Jason Alexander assault, like, you might see it in the same way.
Have you looked back recently at some TV shows or movies and thought alternatively, wow, they really got it right when all these others got it wrong?
Oh, wow. I wish I had come in here with with good examples of that. I'm sure that there are some. It's hard to come up with off the top of my head. But I do think that this, you know, kind of current moment of just sexual harassment being in the air around you, it does color the way that you watch things.
Let's take one more. Karen in Pompton Plains. You're on WNYC. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I might be dating myself, but in the 1980s, there was a movie called Endless Love, and it was this teen couple that fell in love, and I think she wanted to break up with him, and he set fire to the family home. And as a professional musician, I was just appalled by the number of people who wanted the theme song from that movie played at their wedding.
Karen, thank you very much. Before you go, you wrote that recent accusations of real-life sexual assault and harassment, including against the actor Ed Westwick, who played Chuck Bass on Gossip Girl, and Jesse Lacey, the lead singer of Brand New, among others, pushed you to take another look at these love stories that shaped you growing up. So this is another case of a connection between a celebrity's real-life behavior and the storylines or lyrics they perform kind of being tied together. It was the real life creepy examples that led you to look at the fictional ones as closely as you have for this piece?
Yeah, and I want to be clear that, you know, just because Ed Westwick played Chuck Bass, who, like, raped people in the storyline, like, doesn't mean that, you know, it's not proving anything and he didn't write Gossip Girl. But it is an interesting parallel. Like, I don't, at the same time, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence, because the entire culture of the entertainment industry and of our country has been shaped by this norm of harassment or aggressive pursuit or all of the above. And so I think when, you know, the people in the entertainment industry end up, you know, being accused of doing these things, it's not a coincidence that the products that the entertainment industry was making that whole time were tacitly endorsing some of those behaviors.
So to wrap up, I mean, it wasn't too long ago that we all started, you know, facepalming when we look back at how transphobic Sex and the City was, though at the time it felt like a really progressive show. Same with Seinfeld and Race, you could argue. More recently, the HBO show Girls was criticized for lack of diversity, though it improved from its first to its last season. So is Hollywood getting the message?
I think slowly, perhaps. It's still, you know, very male-dominated when it comes to directors. For example, I heard you guys on the news saying, you know, Greta Gerwig was just the fifth woman to get a nomination for Best Director. So we are getting more women making art, and we are getting more men listening to what women have to say and, you know, doing their best to incorporate that into their art. But it's, you know, I think we're at an early stage where it's not going to go away for a while yet until more work is done.
Julie Beck, associate editor at The Atlantic. Her article is called When Pop Culture Sells Dangerous Myths About Romance. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.